Hello and welcome to another episode of the Uncommon Energy Podcast. My name is Trainer Chipperchi, joined as always by my co-host Azul GG. What's happening, Azul? How you doing?
I'm doing good, Chip. stayed home and watched EUIC from my room, my stream setup. Had a good time on the stream. Had a ton of fun watching it. Definitely plan to do more streams like this in the future. It's a ton of fun to like just sit there and watch gameplay live still for sure. Especially in like doing the stream setting, because like I guess in the past, you know, I've watched regionals or stuff that I haven't been at, or ICs or whatever, but you know, doing it live with the stream is definitely a different experience. It's definitely super enjoyable. How about you? You're still in Europe. How's that been so far?
Yeah, it's been a great time. The tournament was awesome. For anyone who doesn't know, I actually casted EUIC. We didn't get to talk about it last week on the cast because it hadn't been officially announced yet. But I did get to broadcast, be a commentator at EUIC. So big thanks to Pokemon for bringing me out. It was a ton of fun. My first like major tournament casting experience. I've done like 3 regionals now at this point, and then several like the Players' Cups, which were all from at home. And yeah, as you can see, our setup's a little different. I'm actually in a hotel room in London right now. My wife and I stayed after EUIC, and we're, you know, doing some sightseeing around Europe for a few days, taking a little bit of a trip, making a trip out of it. So yeah, we're going to do some fun touristy things, which I'm excited about. But yeah, EUIC was an absolute blast. Germany was super cool. Frankfurt was really nice. But yeah, it was a ton of fun.
Nice. Yeah, I wish I could have been there, but I didn't want to get stuck. So I played it safe this time.
I have not heard of anyone getting stuck yet, so I don't know if it happened or not. But
yeah,
not that I have heard of, at least. I don't think anyone has gotten stranded out of the U.S.
I actually know someone. It's not for EUIC, but I know someone who's stuck in Canada right now because they tested positive, and they can't get back in right now. So
unfortunate
it is happening, but I mean, you know, safety first, and that's what, yeah, I just don't want to take the risk of getting stuck over there. So I'm definitely fine with my choice, and yeah, I still enjoyed at least watching the event and watching all the cool decks that everyone came up with. And that's going to be one of the things we talk about today. We're going to be going over, you know, our individual perspectives of the tournament. You know, Chip was there casting, I was here chilling, and then talk about the results of the tournament as well. A lot of interesting stuff happened from decks that did do well and decks that didn't do well. Then of course, as always, I'm gonna be guessing the flavor text this week around, and then
that's right,
talking a little bit about where the meta goes from here. Indy is not too far away. I think it's not just Indy though. I think there's also, actually, I'm gonna pull that up. I think it's Indy, and then there's European regionals, and also is there 2 or 3 Australian regionals this time around? I actually don't know, but those are all coming up soon as well. They're not too far off either.
Yeah, I think Indy's the first thing though, right? I think that the Europe regionals is like a week after or 2 weeks after, maybe. I don't remember exactly.
There is a, but it looks like, yeah, there is Indy, a Latin America regional actually the same weekend.
Okay. Yeah, same weekend. So we weren't totally on top of that. So we're going to definitely be talking about what the meta looks like post-EUIC. Obviously, the results from the tournament were quite different than what I think anyone expected. I don't know that anyone could have predicted exactly what happened leading into the tournament. So we'll talk about all of those things, how it affects future tournaments, and how people should prepare now for those events. But like Azul said, we're going to start off with our individual unique perspectives of the event. So I was there, I was casting, and the setup was really cool. The stage was incredible. It was a way higher production than I think most any tournament I've ever seen. It definitely had more of an esportsy vibe, I would say, compared to like you know, I think like generally at Worlds, I think about that level of production, there's like a lot more hard props like and backdrops on the stage, whereas this was like a big massive screen, 3 huge massive screens on the stage. And it was really cool as well for this tournament because there was 4 different games going on. So there's almost always Pokken tournament, VGC, and TCG. But for this tournament, there was Pokemon Go. And Pokemon Go was actually really cool. During one of my off rounds, I stood and actually watched the Pokemon Go stream for a little bit, and it was really, really cool. I met all of the Go casters. They seemed like cool dudes. And I know they were just like pumped to be there because it was the first big event for their community, you know? So that was really cool to see.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie. It's hard for me to take Pokemon Go seriously. It was funny because they would, during like the downtime of like the TCG rounds, they'd like pan over. And it's funny when you like can't see their screen. It looks like they're just hitting their phone really, really hard. So,
yeah,
it's funny. It's a little funny looking, but I know there's like a ton of depth to the game and all that. It's just hard when I watch them actually do it. When they're competing against each other. It is a little funny looking.
But it definitely is. And even up on the stage, it was kind of funny because, like, you know, up on the stream, you know, you see their screens and stuff. But if you're just watching the players on the stage, they have this huge divider between them. They can't see each other. There's these two judges sitting there looking at each player, and they're just sitting there tap, 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 spin, 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 tap, 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 tap. It is kind of funny, but they were excited. And, you know, Pokemon Go is like, I think still like the biggest game in the world. I mean, it's like that or Minecraft or Fortnite, I think, are like the biggest, highest grossing games in the world, even still, you know, years after it came out. I mean, it's still just got a massive community, I know.
No, yeah, it's definitely cool to have it there. And actually, it makes me more excited to see what kind of stuff they do for Unite and having Unite at Worlds. What that'll be like as well. So that'll be actually very, very cool. I think the stream overall was done pretty well. The new layout is sick that they have, like, for the basically the stream layout to show the players' names and their stuff. The one thing that was kind of missing, I feel like, from the – and I had multiple people in chat be like, yo, what are the players' records? They didn't have the records on the stream, which I think was a little weird. And maybe they took them off the stream because it was confusing to have on stream because it's like, what does that mean during the round? But I feel like it's not – that difficult to kind of digest, so that would be cool to see back because I'm pretty sure they've always had that on there before.
Yeah, I think records is something that's pretty much always been there, so it was also something I was a little surprised to see got chosen to be left off. Also, something that we had in Salt Lake that I really liked was the player cams, so you could see the players' faces while they were playing their games, right? And we didn't have that for EUIC, and I don't think it's like the most necessary element because so much of what's happening in our game is, you know, on the table as opposed to like what the players are, you know, how they're reacting and stuff. But that is definitely an element of the game is player reactions, you know, reading your opponent a little bit sometimes can come up, you know, off of like Marnie's and stuff, you know, how good of a hand are you working with over there? Those type of things. So I enjoyed the player cams, and I'm not sure if that's going to be the plan for future regional streams is to have that or not, but it was definitely something that another aspect that has been on streams in the past that was missing from this one.
I didn't even realize it was missing, so I guess I didn't find it to be that that big of a deal. Sure. I didn't even realize that was missing there. I mean, they messed up, like, there's a couple things they need to be a little bit better with their camera angle changing as well. We missed, like, I think once or twice we missed, like, a full turn. They could definitely be, like, a little bit quicker with, like, and they also, I feel like it's weird when they, like, delay the players from putting their prize cards out. That feels so weird to me because we don't need to see the players lay their prize cards out. Like, if they just, like, let the players fully set up and just do a quick cut to looking at the prize cards and cut back to the gameplay before they start their game, like, that seems fine. But, like, and they've done that for a while where they delay the players from putting out their prize cards and they, like, cut to the prize cam as the players are laying their prize cards. I guess it builds up, like, a little suspense maybe or something with the whole
only prize thing. I think that's the idea. And I do kind of like that little bit of suspense because it's, like, I mean, that makes for kind of funny moments, like in Salt Lake City when we were watching, I think it was Zach Cooper in top four, I want to say,
laying out
his prizes where, he laid out one Gengar. It's like, okay, that's, you know, that's not that big of a deal. Laid out the second one. It's like, ooh, that's a little awkward. And then the third one goes on to the bottom and it's like, oh my gosh. So it does create some cool moments, I think. But I agree, like, it does feel like it, like, holds things up a little bit sometimes for sure.
And it just looks awkward on stream seeing the players like Gustavo was always prepping his prize cards. He's like six there waiting. Like, that just looks awkward and like it's just like kind of like it jams up the flow, I feel like, a little bit. And they if they did it better, like where they cut to the prizes better, like it would be, but sometimes they would miss the layout anyways and stuff like that. So I feel like if they're not gonna get you know, be super clean with it. There's kind of no point to doing it, and just kind of let them lay out the prize cards, cut to it. You'll still have that moment where you see three Gengar prized, right? Like, you still see it.
Yeah, definitely.
You just don't need to, you just don't see them laying them out. And then, you know, they've just kind of like looked at the players from the side view sometimes too long, and we missed, I think throughout the tournament, we missed like one or two full turns, like a player's turn. So then we cut back, and I was like, wait, what's going on? If I remember correctly. So, I mean, it's overall was great. Like, the production value seemed ridiculous. Yeah, the big screens in the back, and then overall, super great. I didn't listen to a whole ton of the casting because I had you guys muted while I was talking over the gameplay myself during the stream for most of it. But I'm sure you guys did a wonderful job.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I casted with Ethan Hegster, Heggy, the whole time. Ethan did a great job. It was his first in-person tournament. And yeah, he killed it. He's a stud. And then obviously got to watch Joe and Ross, the EU casting duo, on the other side. And, you know, they did a great job. They have a great rhythm because they've done it together so much now.
Yeah.
I think Joe is maybe one of just the best casters that we have. He's so analytical. He understands the game super well, obviously, and does a great job at conveying what he sees and, like, you know, future strategies to the audience in a way that's like in-depth enough for the players who understand it, but then also inviting enough to people who don't know the like deep strategies.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Yeah, Joe's pretty good, definitely.
So yeah, it was a ton of fun. The event was great. The kind of feeling in the hall was just like excitement. Everyone was pumped to be there. It was the first internationals since February of 2020. So it's been over 2 years. So everyone was definitely just really pumped to be back. And the ICs just have such a unique feeling compared to any other event, almost more so even than Worlds, to be honest, because there's more players in ICs compared to Worlds, right? Because at Worlds, you have to have qualified, whereas anyone can play in an IC. And especially, this was my first EUIC, but it feels like EUIC specifically is really cool because it's the easiest to get to. Like, it was a really good central location for all of the European countries. So, you know, we had people from just literally every single corner of Europe. And then, you know, obviously also from all of the other three regions, Oceania, the US, and North America and Latin America. And then also a few players from Japan, which was pretty cool. Definitely not something I was always expecting because the Japanese players have a different tournament structure than us. I don't actually even know if the Japanese players who competed are eligible to even earn championship points because they're just not a part of that play Pokemon structure. So I don't even actually know how that works.
I'm pretty sure they don't. They just come over here and like steal our championship points. But it's like, it's definitely cool to see them come over.
And I think they can still earn money and prizes and stuff, right? So they still get that. But yeah, I think they, you know, they just love Pokemon and, so they want to come out and travel and, you know, I think they appreciate the international aspect of these events and it was a lot of fun. We had players from, I guess, moving on to the results of the events, there was 618 total players from all over the world.
Is that just Masters?
Day two had players. Yeah, that's just Masters, 618 in Masters. So I think the cap must have been like 650. 500 and then 50 for each of the additional spots, right?
Yeah, I think that's what it was, yeah.
So we got up to 618, so, you know, had a few no-shows, people who canceled their trips. no one specifically, but... so we ended up with 618, and day two actually ended up having players from all four regions and Japan. We almost didn't have anyone from Oceania, but Kaiwen made it in there.
Yeah.
I was the lone representative from the Oceania region from Australia making it in.
I wonder how many even came over from Australia, because I know a lot of the big names.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
So I don't think a ton did.
Yeah, I don't think Natalie didn't come. I don't think Henry was there, right?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure if like Jordan Palmer was there. I don't think so.
Yeah, I think most of them are like locked up for. I think the thing that most of them were concerned with initially was just getting the stipend. I think most of them are just kind of locked up for their stipend for NAIC. So they're just kind of like, all right, I guess we'll just go to our next local regional and then just kind of, you know, show up to NAIC, show up to Worlds from there. I think there's definitely a decent amount of people going to be coming to Milwaukee regionals actually. So that'll be a very interesting regional for sure because it's the week before NAIC. So it'll be like a mini NAIC.
Yeah, yeah.
It'll be like a mini IC almost.
And it'll be cool too because it's the only U.S. regionals that will have Astro Radiance legal.
Oh, so yeah, that's true.
Only one with that set. So I think there'll be a lot of people excited for the new set because there's some pretty new cards coming out. I think leading up to that, at some point, we'll do like a little bit of like a mini review in a section of a podcast of the set, like hit on some of the key cards, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Before the set comes out, which is very, very soon. Before we know it, it'll be here.
Yeah, it's not too far. What is it? Do we get it the end of May, right? End of May.
End of May.
So yeah, it's coming up soon.
The release weekend is the same weekend as Vancouver Regionals.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, that'll be. I mean, it's gonna be interesting. There's gonna be. It'll be. Have we ever even had a tournament like that before, where it's a regional leading into an IC with a new set, especially a regional that'll be this big? That'll be like such a meta shift, right? Because there's going to be a bunch of people who aren't going to Milwaukee who are testing decks, and there's going to be a bunch of people who are going to Milwaukee who are bringing a deck, but are they bringing their NAIC deck? Are they testing something out? Like, that'll be an interesting meta shift. Of course, it could just be there's a broken deck that gets played in Milwaukee, and then it's just so good no one's able to counter it in time for NAIC, and then it's just, like, kind of dominates both tournaments maybe. But, yeah, that'll be a super interesting development.
I don't really think there's anything that's quite like that in this new set. I mean, I think the Hisuian Samurott seems really good. Obviously, Roxanne, you know, there's crazy things that are probably going to happen with that card. I don't really know. It does scare me to think that Sander is going to have access to building decks with that card. That is definitely a little worrisome.
It's fine. We just have to all play B-Barrel. We'll be fine. Everyone just put the B-Barrel in. Right. We'll survive together.
But we'll talk more about that as we get closer to that set coming out. We're definitely excited for it, though. But, you know, getting back to EUIC and the results from the event, I guess before we talk about the specific decks that made top eight, let's talk about the specific players that made top eight. Because there was actually some really cool storylines in the top eight this weekend. And that's something I'm always looking at as a caster. And something we're always trying to develop throughout the course of an event is like a storyline, you know, following certain players, certain archetypes. You know, round one, we had Tord on the stream versus Magnus Petersen, who's a world champion from the seniors division. That was a really great match to watch. And Tord just absolutely blew Magnus out of the water, it felt like. Yeah, Tord was like, it was very apparent that Tord's deck was like a very good call for the tournament. I don't think Magnus was super well prepared for that. And Magnus was actually only one win away from making top eight. So it would have been really cool if Magnus had been able to make it in. I think he might have squeaked into the top 16. Not 100% sure.
I think he ended
on that, but I know.
I think he ended 32. I think he would have had a swift exit from top eight if he hit an Urshifu again, but
probably.
It was a pretty rough matchup. But yeah, I think he ended top 32. It was one of those weird winning ends where it took you all the way down, unfortunately, when you take the L.
Yeah, so we're always trying to do that. And what I think was really cool is that a lot of the players in the top eight were players that we streamed on day one of the tournament, right? Mm-hmm. So all players who we got to kind of see a little bit of their story in day one, we're updating people as the tournament goes on of like, this player that we had on is, you know, they're at this record four rounds later. So it does get to create kind of cool stories. And then obviously we streamed a lot of Urshifu really early in day one, which we were not expecting to do. We were not expecting so much Urshifu to be super popular. And it's always, and this was also kind of a different perspective from an IC because there's a whole team of people who are like the stream runners, like the stream team. And so this was my first time working with that. So normally for the regionals, the casters just pick every single round and stuff. Mm-hmm. And we still have input and stuff, obviously, but it's really mostly up to the stream team, the stream runners. Mm-hmm. And so I definitely have to give big props to them. They all did a great job picking some good matches. Many people involved there. For sure, I think Ellis was probably like the main one driving force behind the match decisions. I looked over, she showed me a list that she'd written out of like every single day two deck and like what players were playing. So she was really out there scoping the field out, trying to figure out, you know, are we picking a unique deck this round? Are we picking, you know, a top player this round? You know, she did a great job, I think, getting us our stream matches and helped us really develop stories. So of the eight players in top eight, lots of cool things that we were following. Obviously, Gustavo Wada, who ended up winning the event, was the defending European international champion. So I think one of the few people to ever really defend a major tournament like that. I think we talked about that a little bit with Bruno Sermon winning Sao Paulo regionals a couple weeks ago.
Well, Stefan, right?
Right. Yeah. So it's happened a few times, yeah. But it doesn't happen very often. So
yeah.
Gustavo becomes the second person to defend an IC and only the third person to win multiple. So massive congratulations to Gustavo. I interviewed him on the stage after round two when he won his round two match. And he said he felt a lot of pressure coming into this event because he was the former EUIC champion, the defending EUIC champion. And he obviously overcame that pressure since he was able to win the event.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. No, it's super cool to see. I guess one thing I'll mention about as far as the stream and everything, that picking matches and stuff, it was really cool to actually, one thing that they did that was really nice is that during the lunch break rounds, they actually held a match back. And then had them on instead of a ton of delay time. So that was super cool. I hope they keep doing that because I don't think the players mind too much. And yeah, they can go get their lunch, while everyone else is playing, and then they come in and they get to play, and then more content for the stream. So that was actually super sick to see. Way less downtime. So that was nice.
I really appreciated that as well. And I think the goal throughout the weekend was to have as little downtime as possible.
Yeah.
I think that the longest will be right, the will be right back timer was pretty much always a last resort, and we pretty much only used it to switch casting duos. Mm-hmm. There was, I think, one or two times where there was a 7-minute we'll be right back timer for just a little bit longer of a break whenever a round ended super, super early into the round. But for the most part, I think we kept it under 5 minutes, at 5 minutes for the we'll be right back screen specifically. And every other time, there was either a casting duo on the screen talking, or there was some pre-recorded content on the stream going, which I think is way better than the past of just the little slideshow going, right?
Yeah. No, yeah, there was a couple 10-minute ones, but most of them were the 5 minutes, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it was definitely super cool to see Gustavo win back-to-back. That was definitely, and watching his run up to that point. And then, stuff like Frank going deep with a unique deck. It's not the first time Frank's done it at the IC. Did it in OCIC. I don't remember the year. The second one, I want to say.
2018, I think, yeah.
Buzzgarb.
It was with the Buzzwing Carbink deck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Frank does it again. and definitely, I think.
That was really cool, too, because. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I'd say becoming less of a. Because I know Frank says this all the time, or I've seen Frank say it before, he's the player who builds the decks and then his friends do well with it. But definitely, turning the corner. Not only is Frank a good deck builder, but Frank's also a great player. And, making the step to, one placement at a time becoming from a good player and a good deck builder to a great player.
Yeah, I loved seeing Frank do well. Frank's a really good dude. He's someone who I always enjoy talking to at tournaments. And he always loves playing rogue decks, unique things. He likes to try to find places in the format that are underexplored or underappreciated by other players and make use of them. And I think Whimsicott, you actually mentioned Whimsicott last week in the podcast as your sleeper pick for the tournament. And it ended up being a really solid play.
Yeah, no, I was it seems decent from the little that I had played with it leading up into that week. I was like, the Mew matchup's good. I hadn't played against any Urshifus, but I was like, Urshifu should be okay. And then Arceus, you just hit a hammer heads, or you can sometimes win the prize trade. It just seemed solid. And yeah, Frank took it all the way. There was a lot of Urshifu, and it seemed like it was a pretty solid matchup. I think Gustavo's list was maybe just fortunate for Gustavo to be a little bit better in the matchup than the others. But Frank, of course. It was a pretty lackluster finals on Frank's side. So had Frank drawn just a little bit better, even got one game where he got a turn two attack off with the Whimsicott, we could have had a lot closer of a set for sure.
And then some of the other series, stories that we were really looking at, obviously Tord Reklev attempting to win his fourth international championship, couldn't get past Frank, though, and Frank ended up beating Tord in top eight. Though it is still insane that, Tord, I think, had probably one of the best decks for the tournament. Urshifu was obviously probably the best deck for the tournament since Gustavo ended up winning with it. Really solid choice. And then Tord had the Manaphy, so he was just prepped for the mirror matches. And Tord destroyed all of the mirror matches he played throughout the tournament, throughout day two. I think going into top eight with like a 11-03 or something like that record, something ridiculous. 11, I guess it would be 11. Yeah, it would be 11-03, right?
Yeah, it was something.
Which is just absolutely absurd. Pedro Torres trying to aim to win his second Internationals. Pedro won in Oceania in 2017 and has been a really consistent finisher at these ICs. So I know he was really happy to be in the top eight again and making it all the way to the top four. But Pedro also lost to Frank. something that we kind of joked about is just like, you know, Frank, it was almost kind of like Frank was having to run through the Elite Four, you know, like in the Pokemon games, right? Like, you know, he has to get through Tord and then he beats Tord, has to get through Pedro. Couldn't quite beat the Pokemon champion, though, in Gustavo.
Yeah, not quite. Got close, though. Got close, though, for sure. but, yeah, wasn't able to take down the third Urshifu. One of them finally got the best of him. I mean, some other cool things to look at was, you know, Isaiah and Justin playing the same 60. Two great players, obviously, from North America. Neither of them have won an IC. I think this might be both of their first top eight at an IC, at least for Isaiah. I'm sure Isaiah's top eight in multiple ICs in the senior division. But both.
Yeah, he won an AIC in 2018 seniors. But I've even talked to him about that before. I remember a couple years ago saying, like, no, what are you talking about? You're an IC champion. He was like, I mean, yeah, but it's different, you know? Yeah. it's a big difference between masters and seniors. And so Isaiah had an incredible season. You know, an incredible freshman season during 2020, you know, the 2019-2020 season.
Yeah.
That obviously got cut short. So I was glad he's, you know, been able to pick it up and, you know, got a top eight. And Justin didn't really play much the last couple of years, it feels like. So it was cool to see him again. And he, you know, was really dominant at the end of the 2019-2020 season, right? He'd won two regionals that year. Mm-hmm. And he obviously, even though he hadn't really been playing much the last couple of years, was able to pick it right back up and almost didn't miss a single beat.
Yeah, yeah. Meets the beat on Tool Jammer. Besides that, was ready to go.
Okay, easy. true.
And then, I mean, the last two players to mention that made top eight, we had Ty with the Sylveon VMAX deck. And that deck almost, like, it almost kind of felt like it had the same kind of idea as, I mean, Ty even played, like, a Peonia in the deck. It almost felt like it was kind of doing the same thing that Urshifu was deck, just the Urshifu deck was trying to do, just different, just, like, a bunch of different stuff to counter matchups, and had Arceus, I guess, instead of Inteleon for a little bit more of the consistency engine, but it kind of feels similar in the terms that it just plays a bunch of stuff to counter the matchups that are popular, and they did really well. I think Tord actually ended up playing against Ty, and they ended up tying, not IDing, but tying, I think, in the end. So Tord was able to take a game off Ty, but I saw Ty smashed Nico in like round three or four. And Nico didn't draw very well, but the Sylveon seemed like it definitely is puts up quite a fight against the Urshifu for sure. The Sylveon seems pretty tough for them to deal with, but not impossible apparently, because Tord is able to take a game with them. And then they did hit their worst matchup that they could in top eight, which was Mateus with the Mew, and the only Mew in top eight. And that was actually their first major event, which is actually really crazy as well.
Yeah, super big congrats to Mateus. I mean, making your breakthrough appearance at a, you know, major tournament is always an exciting and a nerve-wracking thing. But the fact that it was at an IC, you know, on the world stage pretty much against literally, I mean, possibly one of the best top cuts that we have ever seen, right? With Gustavo, Tord, and Pedro being in there. And then obviously, you know, the other players and Isaiah, Justin, and Frank, obviously all very well-known and respected players as well. But, you know, Gustavo, Tord, and Pedro, you're looking at between the three of them, five IC wins and now six IC wins between the three of them.
Yeah. Definitely very, very stacked.
Which is pretty wild. And something interesting, too, I thought was funny. Mateus, when asked on stage about why he chose to play Mew for the event, his answer was that that was the deck that he had the cards for, you know, which was pretty funny. It's like, I've had these cards, and this is what I came to the tournament with, so it's what I had to play. So, you know, it just also goes to show that if it's, I assume that the reason Mateus has the cards is because he's been playing it for a while and is comfortable with the deck, so You know, making a choice for a deck that you are comfortable with, something you know very well, is a great way to get your first big breakthrough performance.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, definitely. Definitely, yeah, that's sometimes all it takes, just playing, like, a deck you know. I mean, at the very least, you want to be doing that. And ideally, you're playing the broken deck for the tournament, which it looks like this time, it felt like this time around it was Urshifu. Not only did it do super well in Masters, but it also took the Seniors Division Championship as well with Caleb Rogerson. Is that the last name?
Yeah, Caleb Rogerson.
Yeah, I'm not sure. What do you know? Remember the name of the opponent? Caleb Rogerson beating.
Yeah, his name was Rodrigo. I believe.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, Rodrigo.
Yeah.
That and yeah, all of
Rodrigo
the
Rodrigo was playing Arceus Dark.
Yeah, and all the finals matches were super underwhelming. None of them were good. They were all very one-sided. Caleb kind of bopped. Rodrigo, or was it Rodrigo? Roberto?
Yeah. Roberto,
that's
right,
what it is. Roberto kind of bopped Roberto. Roberto didn't draw very well. It's a tough matchup. But, yeah, Roberto kind of got bopped in that one. So shout out to Caleb for winning that. Caleb also won Salt Lake City, right? Which is also the...
That's correct.
The tail for the juniors division as well from Nathan, who beat Luca, I want to say, Arceus Inteleon over the Rapidstrike Malamar. And Nathan also won Salt Lake City Regionals in the junior division. so those are two players that are going to be scary for seniors and masters when they both age up for sure.
Yeah, it's really cool. I've actually worked with both of these players. I coached Caleb for about a year and a half or so before the pandemic, and he actually won the Dallas Regional Championships at the end, at the very beginning of 2020. Yeah. And Nathan, similarly, also won the Dallas Regional Championships in 2020. They're both from my area. So it's actually just kind of an interesting perspective because I know both of them, and I've coached Caleb in the past. And I currently coach Nathan, actually. And Nathan won Salt Lake City as well, won this tournament. It was his first internationals that he ever played in. He didn't even go to NAIC last year, or in 2019. He started playing competitively in the 2019-2020 season, where they like started going to all these big events. And he's just absolutely been killing it. I think he sees the game at a very high level for someone of his age. And... I liked the deck that he chose to play for the event. I always like, you know, want my students to pick decks that they are very familiar with and like feel comfortable with. And he's been playing this deck since like a week after Brilliant Stars came out.
Yeah.
And he's done really well in a bunch of online tournaments with it. He obviously won Salt Lake City with it. And so he wanted to play it. I tried to talk him into including at least one Avery because I felt like it was a good inclusion, but he didn't want to give up like a research or a Marnie or anything. He wanted to keep those better draw options just for the overall consistency, which honestly I think is fine for the juniors division specifically, just because in juniors, I think if you are a really good player and you just play a good consistent deck that you are comfortable with, you are going to do really well.
Yeah, that's basically how it goes. The best players in juniors and seniors is a little bit different, but yeah, the best players in juniors can literally play whatever they want. The best seniors have, I feel like there's a little metagame going on amongst like the top seniors in like the region where like they're metagaming against each other. I guess it's a little bit different now because it feels like a lot of the top seniors aren't traveling to everything because they're already kind of locked up for their day twos and their stipends and so on, or a lot of them have aged up to masters. So it feels like seniors right now is like kind of like an extended juniors division where like no one's really been playing that hard for 2 years. And now all of a sudden they were in juniors and now they're all in seniors, even though they wouldn't have been if they had, you know, been, you know, the seasons had been going on or whatever. But it's definitely interesting how that's happened. But yeah, definitely.
So
go ahead.
Just while we're still on while we're still just on the topic of kind of the juniors and seniors decks, and before I guess we transition into the masters decks, since we're obviously going to be talking about Urshifu, it was 5 of the top 8 spots in the masters division. I want to just talk about Caleb's list a little bit because it was very, very, very unique compared to the other masters division lists. Because he played a really cool tech in the Rowlet, which has the Sky Circus ability, where if you played Bird Keeper from your hand during your turn, you can use Rowlet's attacks for free. And Rowlet's attack is Wind Shard, I think it's called Windshard, and it does 60 damage to any one of your opponent's Pokemon. So a really cool card to just be able to target down Sobbles, get a free prize for no energy at all. And the main reason it's in the deck is to target down Dunsparce specifically, which I thought was really cool. And it's a pretty nice little tech, and it actually makes me wonder if we'll see more of that moving forward in Urshifu decks, because it does seem pretty solid.
Yeah, it definitely seems okay. I wasn't blown away by it for the purpose of KOing Dunsparce, because I feel like you already kind of bop Urshifu anyway, or bop Arceus anyways. If they don't have Manaphy. But in general, I guess, like, even up against the mirror match or other matchups with Inteleon, just being able to pick off Sobbles, that feels like a little bit more beneficial, you know, in like a kind of broader meta sense. But yeah, you kind of already bop.
I mean, it lets you get a prize while you're attaching an energy to the Urshifu on the bench to prep for G-Max Rapid Flow on the next turn.
Yeah, exactly. So it does kind of make sense to kind of include in the deck when you're already playing like double Birdkeeper, or even just a one of Birdkeeper, you know, you can get it back. Or just getting that one prize card can be such a big deal. Like, getting that one extra prize card ahead can completely change how you want to play out the game and how your opponent has approached the game from there as well. So it definitely seems worth it, instead of doing nothing for the turn, to you know, pick up something at the very least.
And now we can move on to the Masters top eight. Like I mentioned, 5 Rapid Strike Urshifu in top eight. When we talked about Urshifu last week, we both said that we didn't feel like it was a deck that would be very popular, but we think it had the potential to do really well. And I think that was true. You know, it was not very popular as far as like the wider meta of the room, but it was really popular amongst top level players. The Limitless crew played it, and a big group of American players played it. And the lists are actually pretty different. And then obviously, you know, there's plenty of other people playing it out there, like outside of those two big testing groups, like Gustavo played it, right? And there's big differences in all of the lists, quite a bit of variety. But I mean, even like, we thought that Urshifu would do okay, but I don't think anyone predicted 5 out of 8. Like, it very much overperformed for what people's expectations were.
Yeah, that was a lot for sure. I mean, I wouldn't have been surprised to see like 2, maybe even 3, depending on who is playing it, of course. And that's always going to be a big deal, I think, in these tournaments in general, is just what are the top players playing, because that's going to make up a majority of the better finishing decks and even top eights most of the time. And you just look at this one, you have very many top notable players, you know, in the top eight. That's just going to be consistent throughout, you know, any of these major tournaments, whether it be a regional or an IC or whatever. That's just going to be how it goes. The better players win more often, which is a good thing, because that means that game's in like a healthy spot as far as, you know, the skill ceiling goes. But yeah, 5 Urshifu is a lot, but whatever the best players decide to bring on the day, you know, that's gonna usually do pretty well. And a lot of the best players at that tournament brought the Urshifu. And yeah, there's a lot of different takes on it. I think one of the one that I thought was like super cool, and I haven't tried it, but is that the Mews that Isaiah and Justin brought were really cool. I don't know about the lack of Snorlax, but I thought the Mews were pretty cool. For sure, just like extra item cards, and then you can also, you know, put an air balloon on it, so you constantly have a pivot, which definitely helps you getting Marnied.
Yeah, very commonly with the deck with Urshifu, you'll see these players playing the game very slowly, looking many turns ahead, and as opposed to just going in with an Assault Gate or going in with a Gale Thrust, they'll attach an energy to a bench Pokemon and then go into Snorlax and Gormandize. Just set up for future turns. And Isaiah and Justin didn't have access to that play, but they were able to make more things happen on their turn because they played Mew. Yep. And I think we saw Mew used to great success by both of them. I think they were collectively on the stream 3 times, and then also Rahul was on stream who played the deck. And, you know, we saw use of Mew in that game as well. Mew, I think, is really cool, though I do agree Snorlax, I mean, it's just good. It just lets you kind of chill, make plays. And Gustavo did play the Snorlax, who ended up winning the tournament. And then Tord and Pedro, who were both in top eight, also played Snorlax as well.
Yeah, definitely really liked the Snorlax. One thing that I didn't like a whole ton, and is one of maybe the biggest standout card in any of them, is the Eldegoss that Pedro played. You know, I get the idea behind it. I think it's probably really, really good in the Mew matchup. But I just felt weird. It felt like high maintenance to include the Eldegoss in the deck. You know, having to commit like level balls and quick balls to find that over finding like Sobbles and Drizzyles feels like a lot. But I think, I guess, like, another thing past that was like, I think how different Gustavo's list was compared to the rest, because I feel like all the other ones are a little bit more similar, but Gustavo like didn't play a lot of the tricks that the other ones played as well. Like, no quick shooting, no Medicham, and then actually played other V Pokemon besides the Urshifu. It almost felt like Gustavos was the most prepared for. It just felt like, I don't want to say the most refined, but it almost feels like it, because it was so different from the other ones, it almost felt like it was more refined than the other lists. But of course, it's hard to really tell what the mindset was behind, you know, why Gustavo included those cards and didn't include the other cards. But it definitely felt like, at least at the very least, probably has a stronger Mew matchup with those options, especially with the Moltres V. But yeah, Gustavo's list felt, it felt more refined when I looked at him.
Yeah, I think the Moltres just gives you more maneuverability in, you know, whatever matchup, right? It gives you just a different two prize attacking option, because the way that the other lists are built, it's like you're pretty much playing to Urshifu always, or to the regular Galarian Moltres, right? And if you're relying on just attacking with Galarian Moltres, a lot of times you're just like not doing much in the early game, which can be okay. But what the Galarian Moltres V does for you is it allows you to put on more pressure. You can take two prize KOs on, you know, things like the Crobats or Lumineon or like whatever else your opponent may be playing, anything with, 190 or less. And then also it gives up two prize cards, which helps you get to your Galarian Moltres a lot quicker. So giving up more prizes seems like it would be bad, but in this instance, it actually helps you get to the strongest attacker in your deck much quicker.
Yeah, it stops your opponent from kind of like picking on your Sobbles and Drizzles too aggressively.
Yeah, true. Sure.
Protects them.
Yeah, because if you're not doing anything during the game, that's what they can do. They can try to pick on your Sobbles and stuff, and or on your Drizzles, so you don't have access to Shady Dealings in Inteleon. And then one other card that was definitely interesting in Gustavo's list is the Piers. And Gustavo made like excellent use of the Piers throughout the weekend. Every single one of his stream games, like Piers got played, it felt like, which is a support that lets you search your deck for a dark Pokemon and an energy card. So it can get you the basic fighting out of the deck if you want to Gale Thrust that turn. It can get you the, you know, basic dark to get in the discard pile for your Galarian Moltres V, or it can get you the Galarian Moltres V, of course, or it can get you the Crobat that Gustavo played, which I think is also a card that no one else had, right? The Crobat V in order to draw more cards. So Piers became a utility support card, and then also kind of a draw card by being able to grab the Crobat out of the deck.
Yeah, no, the Piers was pretty sick, and it was actually interesting. That's like a one thing across all of them was, I mean, Tord and Pedro still played the Octillery, but you know, Gustavo and Isaiah and Justin did not play the Octillery, but Gustavo still had a way to find the Rapid Strike energy in the the Piers, whereas Isaiah and Justin, they either had to draw into it or had to Raihan into it. And it seemed like it didn't hurt them too much, but you know what? It probably did hurt them in the mirror matches, I would imagine, having no way to find your Rapid Strike energy. If you just the person who's going to fall behind on the G-Max Rapid Flow trade, like if, I mean, I'm sure that was definitely an advantage for Pedro up against Bradner, which is like, you're more often going to G-Max Rapid Flow first. So you G-Max Rapid Flow, they G-Max Rapid Flow, and then you Raihan G-Max Rapid Flow, and then they're just out of Drizzles and Sobbles, right? And they're just all done, and they have no more left. And then you're just behind, and they still have potentially Drizzles and Sobbles to work with as well. So some way to find the Rapid Strike energy definitely seems good, but it definitely didn't hurt. Doesn't seem like it hurt Justin and Isaiah too much, but it's definitely very interesting to see the differences in some of these lists. Another one is like Hoopa wasn't in all the lists. Gustavo didn't play Hoopa. I think everyone else, I don't know if Isaiah and Justin played Hoopa, but yeah, it's definitely interesting to see the differences. Definitely a lot to like figure out and test, because I haven't put a whole ton of time in with any of these decks, so or this deck in general, the Urshifu Dark stuff. So a lot of stuff to take away from this tournament specifically, because I mean, not all five of the lists, but you know, at least three of them were pretty different, for sure.
Yeah, and one other, I guess, kind of more unique card in Gustavo's list was the Energy Retrieval.
Yeah,
which is not something that really many other people have been playing. Which is, it's a cool card because it allows you to play boss's orders and get energy back for your Moltres, right?
Yeah.
Whereas you can't do that with other lists to get back energy, because you're having to play the Clara to get back the energy. So you're having to use your supporter on that. You can't use it on something like a boss or, you know, whatever else, you know, whatever other plays you wanted to make, like, you know, a Piers play or something like that. So definitely kind of a cool one. And then Tord had the Manaphy. Tord was packing the Manaphy. That was definitely the unique thing in Tord's deck. And that, I think, was the reason that Tord went undefeated throughout the event until top eight, because there was so much Urshifu at the top tables, and Tord just slaughtered the mirror match with Manaphy because he had it and they didn't.
Yeah, I mean, Tord beat Gustavo, beat Justin, but was also, unfortunately for Tord, the first Urshifu to hit Frank in top eight and be swiftly taken out by Frank. Yeah. Had the Manaphy. So, like, if Tord just only had hit other Urshifus or basically probably anything else in cut, Tord's in a super good spot to go very deep, because the Manaphy's a huge, if you're getting G-Max Rapid Flow in the mirror and you can't G-Max Rapid Flow, especially with how limited of resources the deck actually has overall, it's very hard to like play a sustained war of attrition in that one when you can't G-Max Rapid Flow and your opponent can, because you're both sitting there and probably Sherilyn, but you know, every other turn they're taking two prize cards, right? And they're limiting your outs to your resources. So definitely a huge advantage for Tord in the mirror match. And took out Gustavo, took out Justin, probably would have taken them out again if he had hit him in cut.
Yeah, definitely. And that was actually something Tord chose to do. So in round number 14, Tord could have intentionally drawn with Justin. He was guaranteed to be first seed regardless.
Yeah.
But there was three players who were going to be IDing to 32 match points. And the three players who were going to be at 32, which meant these were the only players that could possibly have been the eighth seed, were Ty with the Sylveon, Mateus with Mew, and Frank with Whimsicott. All three matchups that I don't know that Tord was pumped to be playing against. I think you can do fine. You can do fine against Mew, obviously. But Whimsicott, doesn't feel like the most fun to play against as Urshifu. And then also Sylveon, I think, is probably the harder. Well, even harder, potentially, just because the Sylveon has so much HP and just, can hit through your Urshifus really efficiently. And Ty also had Urshifu as an option as well, which I guess doesn't matter as much against Tord since Tord had the Manaphy, but Tord made the decision to play in round 14 and try to beat Justin, to put Justin at 32 match points so that he had a chance to play Justin in top eight, since it was obviously a matchup that he was comfortable with.
Fortunately for Tord, did not work out how they wanted and ended up hitting Frank in the top eight. Was not able to dodge the Psychic Monty. I feel like Sylveon was probably the hardest of the matchups as well for the Urshifu deck. I feel like Sylveon was the maybe Frank's deck if it gets that turn to attack is just as bad. But Mew is definitely the one that they were all prepared for and were comfortable with hitting for sure. So Tord missed the 50-50 on that one, I guess, this time around. That's the Urshifus, five of them, all playing different lists. A lot of stuff for a lot of people to try out, whether that be to prepare. And that's one of the scarier thing is like preparing against Urshifu. Like, what lists do you assume they have when you go up against them in Indiana? Like, you're gonna be like,
assume nothing. You can assume nothing.
Do they play Metacham? Like, do they play quick shooting? Like,
yeah, that is definitely gonna be an interesting dynamic here. And then also, like, how do people combine the lists, right? Like, if you see Moltres V, does that instantly mean there's no Metacham? Not necessarily. If you see Crobat, does that instantly mean that there's, the peers and the Galarian Moltres V? Not necessarily. So that's one of the fun things of IRL tournaments is just, like, you don't really know what you're going to get hit with. You don't know what your opponent's going to be packing. And speaking of not knowing what your opponent's going to be packing, the top four Mew list had some pretty interesting cards in it. So we already talked about Mateus, obviously, making a deep run at his first major event. Congratulations to Mateus. Very, very cool. But was playing the Pumpkaboo with its Pumpkin Pit ability, which allows you to discard a stadium card from play. Very good answer, in theory, right, to Path to the Peak, since now all of your Quick Balls and all of your Ultra Balls become outs to the Pumpkaboo.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I think, I've been trying to test it a little bit in Mew recently. It's solid with the scoop up net. I feel like that's kind of the package you want to play. If you play Pumpkaboo, I almost feel like you want to play the scoop up net, because the scoop net also acts as like a switch card to reset Technoblast as well. Yeah. So it's not like a dead card if you're not picking up Pumpkaboo. And you can always play it at any point to reset a Meloetta or an Oricorio and just draw more cards with Genesect as well. So this Kupnet's like not something that's going to break up your hand too often. And yeah, it can be kind of come as like a... That's what I've been doing. I've been cutting a switch card for Scoop Up Net when I've been trying it out. I'm not thrilled with it overall, but I think it's like a solid choice. But I feel like the meta's shifting away from Paths of the Peak, so I think it was probably a decent idea to include for EUIC, but I think it's going to be less relevant. You probably just want to go back to your three or probably three stadiums, to be honest. You don't even think you need four. Because there's just less path. People got to deal with Urshifu. We don't got time to path Muse. We got to, like, you know, hope our two bat paths do it. And if they don't, oh well, we got to put some Mana Fees and some Dunsparce in our deck or something, because Urshifu is, I think, enemy number one, threat number one right now in the meta. And then also no Marnie in the list as well, which is definitely, I think, a really good play to play going into UIC. I had been testing out a lot in Mew going into UIC, and I think I would have definitely rocked one if I had played Mew, you know, come tournament day, because I think, like, a lot of decks, like, we just kind of, like, and that's what we saw with the Urshifu decks. A lot of decks are just playing for the fact that, you know, you can't disrupt your hand at all. And then that's where Marnie comes in to kind of, you know, shake things up.
Yeah, the Marnie is super good against the Urshifu decks because they just try to build a massive hand and play to the, you know, big Galarian Moltres plays at the end of the game. So by playing Marnie, you can disrupt them. And also, it becomes a nice card against Path of the Peak because it's a supporter card you can play to help you see a new hand, to help you dig for a switching card or a stadium, whatever you might need. So I think that Marnie was definitely popping up in a good amount of Mew lists leading up to this event, I feel like. And there were a lot of players that had the card. Like, I think Gabe Smart, who ended up in top 32, was playing the Marnie. So I definitely think it was a really good card to have in your Mew deck for this event. But Tayus's list was really cool. Something else about the Scoop of Net that I thought was a really cool play that you can have access to since you have the card in your deck. And this is actually something we saw from Mateus on the stream, is against the Urshifu decks, one of the plays that they will go for is they will try to, or, like, sometimes go for. It doesn't always work out like this, obviously. But if you put Oricorio in play, and they use Hoopa's Assault Gate to do 70 damage to either the Oricorio or a Meloetta, it leaves it with 20 HP, which makes it a target for Yoga Loop. So something that Mateus did in the streamed match against Urshifu was actively kept the Scoop Up Net in hand, had opportunities to just burn it to draw more cards, but chose to hold on to it because whenever, I think it was Justin that he was playing against, right? Yeah. Justin went for the Assault Gate into a one prizer, and Mateus Scoop Up Netted it. So now Justin didn't have access to the Yoga Loop play. So that's another kind of cute thing you can do with the Scoop Up Net. Obviously not in the deck for that specific scenario, but, you know, that's definitely kind of a niche thing that can come up and makes it makes for good use of the card.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely another, like, niche situation to utilize it in. And then maybe, I think the biggest surprise definitely of the top eight, or the most unpredictable deck that made top eight, was the Sylveon. It was more of like a rapid strike. It's like a box. Like I said, it feels similar to what the Urshifu deck's trying to do, where it's just like, I'm going to build this deck to literally counter all the decks in the meta. It feels similar to what Ty did with Sylveon, where it's like, and it's like the lines are super thin in that deck as well, because it was one of the biggest things when we saw Robin win Liverpool with the Urshifu Moltres deck. It's like, well, there's so many one-ofs in here. And then, you know, Ty's deck wasn't that far off. You know, there's a bunch of 2-1. There's a 2-1 Urshifu VMAX line, 2-1 Sylveon, 2-2 Arceus, I believe. There's a Peony in there. Mm-hmm. There's like a one-of Fan of Waves, 3 Battle VIP Pass. Like, there's a bunch of stuff in the deck. And definitely the biggest surprise to me that made cut. But I think one of the things that helped it is it has probably a solid Urshifu matchup, because Sylveon is just really hard for Urshifu to deal with.
Yeah, I think it does have a solid Urshifu matchup on paper. Big props to Ty. I always love seeing someone come in with a super unique deck like that and doing really well. That was really, really cool. Ty, I believe this was also, you know, their first big tournament finish. So congrats to them on that, because, you know, making a deep run with a deck that you are a big fan of. And I think that's actually something Ty said in their winner's interview after one of their stream games, was like, yeah, I just love this deck. This is like a deck I've been playing for a while. I'm a big fan of it. And so it was just kind of the natural choice for the tournament for them. And they made top eight. So huge props. Congratulations. Love to see it. I don't know how prevalent this deck will be or even should be in the meta moving forward. This could be like a little bit of a one-off, but it's definitely not a bad deck by any means. I don't know that it's really going to become a mainstay, though, as something that you should prep against leading into tournaments.
No, I definitely won't, I don't think. Definitely something you don't have to worry about. If it did well again, I wouldn't be, like, ridiculously surprised. As ridiculously surprised, because the deck's proven that it can keep up with most decks. One thing that might become more of a mainstay is the Whimsicott, though, because there's been some results with this deck before EUIC in online tournaments quite a bit. Shout out to Thomas Harvey, who's like constantly placing in online tournaments with Whimsicott B-Barrel. That's like, I see them all the time in top cuts in online events. So this deck has been, you know, building up steam headed into UIC, and then, you know, Frank pulls out their build and, you know, makes the finals, which is definitely gonna put a bigger spotlight on it than the online tournament placements, of course. But I think now it's got it's got the fire behind it to actually push to become maybe not like a popular meta deck, but I think it's a deck you probably don't want to take like a hard auto loss to anymore.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think if your deck has a bad matchup to Whimsicott, naturally, you need to reconsider playing that deck or reconsider how you've built the deck, because it is definitely something that, you know, you should expect to face at some point in one of these major tournaments. Now that it's done well, now that it's a known quantity. And there's a lot to like about this deck. You know, its matchups are pretty cut and dry, right? If your opponent is playing a lot of special energies and you can draw into the pieces to get up your lock quickly, you're going to do really well. But other than that, like, the deck is just kind of straightforward. And I think that would be kind of my one thing that I don't love about it, is that there's not a lot of room for you to make plays. As opposed to something like Rapid Strike Urshifu, where your skill as a player is, you know, the backbone of the deck, because if you make a mistake on like turn two, it can affect what happens to your game in turn six, right?
Yeah.
Whereas Whimsicott, it's like, I need to get down a Whimsicott and put an energy on it, and then I pass
and repeat,
and then I need to play research and find another energy and an evolution.
Yeah, I think the biggest skill with the deck is the biggest thing you need to understand with that is when to V-Star power, because I think we definitely saw there were some opportunities for Frank to, I think, have taken advantage of even in the finals, like some earlier V-Star power, yeah, especially to pressure the Moltres, because the Moltres was such a problem when it did get into the active and start swinging. And actually, Whimsicott actually just won the most recent late night tournament that happened tonight, going 13-3-1. So, yeah, I mean, it's out there. And that was like 200, almost 300 players in that tournament, I think. So, yeah, it's out there, and it's making waves. So, and it was the third most popular deck in the tournament. So, yeah, people are definitely wanting to try it at the very least. Going to be definitely a lot more played. Yeah, there's not as much skill expression with the deck. It kind of just takes advantage of the meta. And if the meta drastically shifts, right, Whimsicott will fall off if the decks can't still be taken advantage of. But in the current meta, it's good against Mew. It's solid against Arceus, I want to say. If they get off that first, what's it called, before you slow them down for a turn, the first Trinity Nova before you can slow them down for like a turn, you're probably in a bad spot. But I feel like it goes about 50-50 in that matchup most of the time. That's all you need in some matchups. And the Urshifu matchup seems good sometimes, but other times it seems like it might not be so good. Maybe a little bit more to test out there for the Whimsicott and see if Moltres V really is kind of too much for it to handle. So that's something for the Whimsicott players to test out. But overall, solid deck, and I definitely expect way more of it moving forwards for sure, because before there was kind of none of it. So now, I mean, way more, you know, maybe from 5 to 10 or whatever, but we're going to be an increased amount for sure.
I think the fact that Frank was able to beat both Tord and Pedro in cut is proof that it has a good Urshifu matchup, right? Because Tord and Pedro are players who are going to be aware of their outs, of like the way that they need to play certain things. Like, they definitely had been thinking about the Whimsicott matchup for their deck leading into cut, and, you know, Frank was still able to come out on top.
Yeah.
Gustavo's deck, I think, was a little bit more well-equipped to handle it. Frank just drew really poorly in the finals as well.
Oh, yeah.
I would have really been interested to see how it would have played out if Frank had drawn normally, had been able to get off a turn two trick wind. Like, was the Moltres V that Gustavo played enough to, you know, kind of combat the onslaught of Whimsicott early?
Yeah, because there's also 4 Marnie, or I think there's 3 Marnie in Frank's deck, but also the Avery's, which can be a little bit disruptive if they go for a keep calling or just fill up their bench. But yeah, heavy Marnie decks is something that the Urshifu deck is currently taking advantage of in the meta, or lack of heavy Marnie decks is something that Urshifu is currently taking advantage of in the meta for sure. They play so many one-ofs, you know, they burn their first Cynthia's Ambition or their research. You Marnie them, they have no heavy draw supporter for the rest of the game to kind of build up a big hand to then just kind of work off of the rest of the game. You can really keep the pressure on them with the Marnies whenever they get any kind of setup in their hand going. going. So yeah, that's one of the things that are definitely taking advantage right now. That there's a lack of decks that play a lot of Marnie. So if we get more of those in the meta, it's definitely going to also hurt Urshifu as well. I guess the biggest surprise that didn't make cut was a lack of a dedicated Arceus deck. But
yeah,
there's a lot of Urshifu, and it feels like a lot of people aren't on that Manaphy plus Dunsparce, you know, train yet. Although there was one that made top 16 that did play Manaphy and Dunsparce, so maybe that's why they did so well overall as far as Arceus decks go.
Yeah, I think that Manaphy is probably just something you have to play in an Arceus deck now. Dunsparce is not enough, and Urshifu is now a much more known quantity. It's going to be way more popular than it has been. You know, it still wasn't that popular at this event despite having five finishes. It just, you know, was proven that, you know, the group of good players who played it, you know, hit the right matchups and played it well enough and tested the deck well enough to know that they could, you know, take it all the way. And yeah, but moving forward, like in Indy and even in the Latin American regionals, I would expect Urshifu to be much, much, much more widely played. And you definitely need to have a game plan against it with whatever deck you bring.
Oh, yeah. And I think that was probably true for EUIC if you've been able to make that call. But it was definitely a, I don't know if it was that hard of a call to make, because I think if it's one of those situations where it's like, you know, some good players are going to be playing it and more good players will be playing it because of what happened at Liverpool. If your goal is to win the tournament, you probably have to go through Urshifu, to be honest, if you had sat there and thought about it really, really hard about going into EUIC. Yeah. But now, definitely outside of, you know, just trying to beat that one good player in top eight, potentially, you're going to have to beat a couple in Swiss now, probably going into this, not next weekend, but the 2 weekends from now of regionals, right? You're going to be have to look into going to go through multiple Urshifus, maybe day one and day two. So definitely gotta be prepared for it. Put your Manaphy's in, start testing stuff. See if it even beats it. What if Manaphy doesn't even work? What if you're still losing? Two Manaphy, three yeah, Manaphy, true. Get them in there.
Okay, well, calm down there.
I gotta imagine,
get out of hand.
Once you start benching Manaphy and maybe even Dunsparce, that Avery's gonna come through and wreak havoc on your bench still for sure. So
that is true.
I don't even know if it's gonna if it is enough. I guess that's something we'll have to you know, see. And that's what people are gonna have to test out. Is the Manaphy enough to kind of deal with Urshifu, or is the deck maybe just that good?
Yeah, and I think like Arceus decks can also you know, play other things, right? Like the Darkness type Arceus deck, Hoopa V is super good against Urshifu because it's got a lot of HP as a basic. And, yeah, you know, if you're playing dark energies for like your Crobat VMAX potentially or whatever, you know, it can also be a solid option in the Mew matchup. So, you know, it's kind of just a two dimensional card where it's got uses in multiple places. And yeah, Urshifu has a hard time dealing with it for sure. The one thing I'll say about it is like you can't like power it up out of nowhere. So because of that, it makes it a little tougher because the Urshifu can always like prep for it or like, you know, be mindful of when the Hoopa's going to come in and try to soften it up early. But
yeah,
I mean, if you're playing in someone like Gustavo who doesn't have quick shooting Inteleon, it's going to be really difficult to deal with that Hoopa.
Yeah, the Hoopa V is a threat. Yeah, there's probably a bunch of other stuff out there that works pretty well as well. Maybe some other psychic attackers you could...
Yeah, that Granbull V, that's a card I've talked to you about before.
No shot. There's got to be something better than Granbull V. It hits itself, bro. It's softening itself up for the Urshifu.
Oh, so does Moltres. Like, I mean, come on. It's like, you know, it's fine.
All right. I guess the last deck we should mention probably is Sander's deck, of course. One of the everyone's always excited to see what Sander plays, I think, and had a really cool Umbreon, like infinite loop healing wall stall deck, like kind of like a Wailord deck almost, to be honest. It kind of felt like if you're going to compare it to like some like previous wall stalls, but you could win on prize cards because you're attacking with Eldegoss to recover your Birdkeeper or your Cheryl. And the way the strategy for the deck kind of works is you have to set up two Umbreon VMAXs. I know it's weird to say, but you actually are attacking with them sometimes because they did include single strike energy. And I think that's probably how the Mew VMAX matchup probably went sometimes, is you'd actually attack with your Umbreon. Maybe there's other matchups as well. But the coolest part of the deck, which doesn't involve attacking with Umbreon, is you get a Sun and Moon badge down on one of your Umbreons, and you get an Air Balloon down on one of your other Umbreon VMAXs, and then you send up your Eldegoss, and you get a supporter back, like a Birdkeeper or a Cheryl, and you can heal your Umbreons, or you can grab the Birdkeeper, so that way when you put your Eldegoss back in your deck, and then you send up an Umbreon, let's say, with the Sun and Moon badge, your opponent hits it, and then you, you know, get your Eldegoss, out of the deck by top decking it. Or if you don't top deck it, you can use Pukumuku to then draw into it after that. And then use Eldegoss, put it on the bench, get back Cheryl, Birdkeeper in, or you have the Birdkeeper out of the hand. You can Birdkeeper into your Eldegoss, draw your Eldegoss, Birdkeeper into your other Umbreon, draw your Eldegoss. Eldegoss gets a Cheryl. You put the Eldegoss back in your deck. And then on the next turn, they hit the other Umbreon, and then you Cheryl both your Umbreons, and then you Eldegoss for a Birdkeeper once again, and you repeat this until your opponent scoops, they deck out, you run out of time, and you tie, or you draw six prize cards. So, super cool deck. I know Sander had like talked about this before the set had even released with the DTE, and finally brought it to a tournament. Did not get the top eight that I would have predicted Sander would have ended up with, but still a solid finish overall, and did really well with another really, really cool deck.
Yeah, I think that maybe one of the downsides, I feel like Sander even said the Mew matchup, if you start an Umbreon V, a two-prizer, the Mew matchup is, like, not the best. But if you start a one-prizer, like, Mew matchup, Mew is great, right? It's a very good matchup.
Yeah.
But, you know, them getting that those two prizes really quickly just makes it tough for your deck because this deck doesn't – it sets up, it's kind of infinite over the course of a few turns at the beginning of the game where you get into a position where your opponent can never take a one-hit KO on the Umbreon. So, yeah, it was really cool, obviously, utilizing cards that nobody is ever thinking about, right? The Sun and Moon badge. Love to see stuff like that. Sander's definitely become one of my favorite players to, follow and watch what they choose to come up with for events. Because he sees the game in such a different way from anyone else, it feels like right now, where is always analyzing the meta and exactly what counts of lists are popular and how you can really take advantage of that. Because if you know what people most likely are going to have in their deck, you can, abuse that knowledge to, in the ways that you play and in the ways that you build your deck to run them out of those resources if you know that what their counts are.
Yeah. And I actually think that the way you kind of broke it down, the player that I think has the same kind of mindset and looks at the game similar to that is Isaiah Williams, actually. When he would ever like try and build decks, especially around control decks, there would always be so many one-ofs. And when I would test with him and we worked as our group, we'd always be like, what if you prize this? What if you prize that? He's like, no, you have this or you have that. Actually, the way you broke that down reminds me of Isaiah. But yeah, Sander definitely the only player in the game currently who does kind of like look at and kind of build decks in that way from who at least succeeds at it, I guess, as well. That's a big thing as well, because I'm sure there's a lot of players out there who are trying some wonky stuff, but Sander takes it to the next level because not only does Sander bring the wonk, but also gets the dubs as well. So
And Stefan Eriksson, I believe, also played the deck and got top 64 with it, finished in day two as well. So there's a couple people out there with the deck. It definitely seems solid. Now that the kind of lock is not the lock, but like the loot is out there and it's like a known quantity what the deck is like, Sander had a great stream game against an Arceus deck, so you can really see, optimal decision making with the deck if you want to go watch that stream game. Because, I think it was a great display of how the deck is meant to function, right?
Yep.
It makes me wonder if we will see more of it leading into Indy. It's definitely something that with enough practice, someone could pick up and do well with. It seems much less complicated of a lock than something like, his last control deck, right?
Yeah, definitely. No, I think we'll definitely see more people playing with it. And if you guys want to watch it, the round is actually up on my YouTube channel, AzulGG. You can check it out over there. I cut up the round and put it on the YouTube channel where I react to the loop. And, yeah, it was super cool to see. And there's also a bunch of other – like, you just have to go watch it. Like, it's not just that. There's a bunch of other stuff in that that makes the deck work. So I definitely recommend, maybe getting list off their Twitter, at Sander something. I actually don't know the Twitter off the top of my head. Go check out Sander's Twitter, steal the list. But then also if you want to watch the gameplay from it, it's on my YouTube channel, so you can check it out there. But I think it's time to move on to everyone's favorite segment, Chip. And
everyone's favorite segment. That's right. Guess that flavor text.
And this actually
where one of us prepares. Yeah, what's up? Go ahead.
Instead of going to EUIC, that's what I've been training for this moment all week. This is why I actually didn't go to EUIC. So I can extend
Stop.
My lead.
Stop.
All right, hit me with it, Chip.
There's no shot you're gonna get this one. So the idea of this segment is that one of us each week will come to the other with the flavor text bit at the bottom of a Pokemon card, which is also usually a Pokedex entry. and read it out, and the other person has to guess what the Pokemon is. And so this week's card, are you ready, Azul?
I'm ready.
All right. With sly cunning, it tries to lure people into the woods. Some believe it to have the power to make crops grow.
Oh, man. I think I actually know, like, I think I know this one, but I can't.
I think there's no way that you know this one.
I think I've heard this one before. So I don't know why.
I don't know why,
but I'm thinking of Trevenant. That's the thing that's in my head. But crops. Now I'm thinking of Cacturn for some reason. Like Cacturn's not a crop. I'm trying to think of like wheat, but so with sly, read it to me again. Give me it one more time.
Yeah. With sly cunning, it tries to lure people into the woods. Some believe it to have the power to make crops grow.
With sly cunning. So when you say sly and cunning, I think of Sneasel or Weavile, but I don't think they're growing crops. Is there a crop Pokemon is what I'm thinking. I'm trying to think about, like, vegetables. Is there any Pokemon that look like vegetables? I can't think of a Pokemon that looks like a vegetable, but I feel like it has nothing to do with that.
Hey, I think we need to guess.
Okay, now I'm thinking of Punkaboo because it's a pumpkin, so I'm going to go with Punkaboo.
Oh, a last second change. And it didn't matter because none of your guesses were correct. The correct answer is Morgrem.
Who? Oh, the...
the middle evolution of Grimmsnarl and Impidimp. Morgrem.
That thing has nothing to do with Force or Cross.
This card comes from Fusion Strike, the single strike version. With sly cunning, it tries to lure people into the woods, and some believe it to have the power to make crops grow. And I definitely have to say that Morgrem looks like someone who would try to lure you into the woods. So
and make your crops grow.
Stay away from Morgrem, kids. It's not a good idea.
All right. Well, I wasn't able to extend my lead, but that's fine. You'll have a chance to miss next week. But let's move on to wrapping up. The last thing we're going to talk about is, where does the meta go from here? Especially moving towards not next weekend, but the weekend after, we got Indy Regionals and that regionals in Latin America. I think the biggest thing is just like, where does Urshifu stand? And I think that the biggest thing, I mean, the answer to that is just like, does Manaphy actually counter it? I think is the real question. Because if it doesn't, what beats Urshifu?
Yeah, I think it's like a TBD type of thing. You need to test it out. And I'm sure someone will come up with a list that is really good into the expected meta and also plays Manaphy. Because Manaphy is just good against Urshifu. Yeah. It's really good against Urshifu. But, you're not going to play Manaphy in your Mew deck, right? Because Urshifu doesn't even, use Urshifu in that matchup. And it's like, does Manaphy even fix the matchup as an Arceus deck, or is it still just too tough? Obviously, it doesn't help you as Jolteon because you're weak to fighting. So I think Manaphy as a card is good against Urshifu, but where does it fit the best? And that's, I think, the thing that needs to be determined.
Yeah, I mean, I think Arceus decks, even if it doesn't fix the matchup and it's still tough, Arceus decks like have to play Manaphy now, I feel like. Because you just give up too many prize cards too fast. You're weak to fighting. And even if they're not one-hit KOing you, they're punching you, they're KOing your Dunsparce. Like, you need to protect the Dunsparce or just, like, protect your bench or something. You just need to do something. So, I mean, I think in honestly, for sure.
What if we're in a position where, like, the deck to play is just towards deck, right? You just play Rapid Strike Urshifu with Manaphy. Is that where we're at right now? Because the deck is obviously incredibly powerful. So if you just have that card to beat the mirror, is that the deck to play?
I mean, I think all the Urshifu, I think if you play Urshifu, you have to play Manaphy. Like, I think you're trying to beat the mirror at this point. Like, I don't think you're going to, I think you're just going to go the route that Tor took and be like, I'm going to play this deck. All my other matchups are comfortable. I think other good players will play this deck. So I'm going to play the Manaphy myself. So I just win the mirror. And I think everyone's going to do that. And then it's going to become kind of a weird Avery off, I think. Because I don't know if you're going to cut the Avery is so good in the mirror match. It's so good up against decks that are going to try and be playing Manaphy because you cut their bench. So you're gonna have this weird Avery off in the mirror. you're just going to be taking, you're not going to be taking prize cards, but you're cutting into the resources so heavily, and they're going to be trying to keep the Manaphy on their bench. Like, what do you even have left on your bench at that point? You got, you hold like a Sobble and an Octillery or something. Like, the mirror match is definitely not a matchup I want to play if everyone's playing Manaphy, for sure. But also, yeah. Urshifu just might, they might, what might happen is the Manaphys get added, but then Urshifu just has a solution for Manaphy, and then they just get to add that, and then they're still right where they are. But maybe it won't be able to be found out before, you know, Indie Regionals.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how the meta will develop. And kind of, I guess, a question that we should answer is, should Urshifu VMAX be considered a Tier 1 deck? And I think to me right now, the answer is yes, for sure.
Yeah, I think so. I don't see any reason not to put it up there with the rest of them. It was a little bit iffy, I think, after Liverpool. And maybe if I had personally like played more with the deck, because I don't put like any games in with the deck after Liverpool and it became a deck. I didn't really put any games in with the deck, so I didn't really have an opinion on it. But I think if I had, I would have been like, okay, this is just really good. And yeah, it's a Tier 1 deck for sure. And then I think it is possible that I think Manaphy takes it off that. And it is maybe one of those decks where it's like when people are playing Manaphy heavily and are like prepared for Urshifu, it's not good. But when people aren't, it is good. Because the meta hasn't developed to the point where it's like, okay, does Manaphy answer Urshifu? We just don't know yet, right? No one was playing Manaphy, or very few people were playing Manaphy at EYC. But as soon as they are, is Urshifu in trouble? And if it is, then maybe it just falls off again, right? And it just becomes an irrelevant deck until maybe people stop playing Manaphy, or maybe it doesn't have its chance to come back into the meta before it shifts with a set release or rotation or whatever, right? So lot to be tested right now.
And I guess another question would be, where does Mew sit right now? Because right, like most of the Urshifu lists, I think we're pretty well equipped for the Mew matchup, even though Mew can still win. It feels like, you know, they're ready for it. So is Mew in a healthy spot? Is Mew still BDIF, which is what everyone has still adamantly been saying up to this point? And I don't know that we really should be considering Mew the BDIF right now.
Yeah, I think it depends on Manaphy, to be honest. If Manaphy does counter Urshifu and like pushes it off, like if Urshifu just can't compete if people are playing Manaphy, then I think Mew is still the BDIF, right? Because I don't think Mew's not competing just because Urshifu, just because Manaphy gets added to decks, right? It makes everything better for Mew. So I think that's the biggest question. So I would say it's probably Tier 1 alongside Urshifu for now, but you know, the jury's still out on whether or not Urshifu can handle the swarm of Manaphys coming for it. And if it can, then I think Urshifu moves to that BDIF spot, and then we have Arceus and Mew in kind of that Tier 1 or Tier 2, if we don't put a Tier S, whatever, you know, just right under it. But that's definitely how it would stack up, I think.
Yeah, and Arceus definitely feels like it underperformed in Frankfurt, right? No top 8 finishes is definitely underperforming, but it was still really popular and still had good finishes. There was a lot of players in top 16, top 32, and in just day 2 in general with the deck. And I think, you know, making day 2 at an IC is considered a very good accomplishment because the playing field is just really, really tough at these big, you know, international level events because so many of the top players travel to them. So yeah, just even making day 2, it should definitely be considered a solid finish, a solid accomplishment. So lots of Arceus still in day 2. And there were some interesting decks running around for Arceus. There was some Lycanroc VMAX out there. There was Arceus Malamar VMAX, which we got to feature on the stream. There was actually a couple players playing that, you know, Alex Wilson made top 64 with the Arceus Dark deck, which is something you and I were big fans of heading into this event. And then Pablo Meza made day 2 with Arceus Inteleon, just kind of a more straightforward list, right? So where is Arceus right now? What is the best variant? And what should, you know, and does Manaphy kind of naturally fit into pretty much all of them?
I think it has to for the most part, unless you come up with, like, if you play something like the Hoopa V, then maybe you don't need Manaphy because you just win the prize trade. Maybe you're like, okay, you Gale Thrust me, and now I bop you back and I'm ahead on the prize trade. Because you're like almost most games, Urshifu's not drawing the first prize card, right? Like, they're almost always drawing the follow up prize cards, right? Or even sometimes in like the Mew matchup, you don't draw prize cards till your opponent's taking 3 prize cards, right? So, yeah, I mean, Arceus, there's still so much room and flexibility. I think maybe Arceus decks have to start to get away from the Inteleon build because I think you open up so much more space in the deck.
Inteleon is obviously like the best draw support in the format is through Inteleon, but it takes up so much deck space. So you have to consider, is it worth committing this many spots to this engine when I could, you know, just commit 4 to 6 spots to a B-barrel engine.
Yeah, and it actually, to me, it's just not as fun. Like, that's why I like the B-barrel Arcus deck so much more. It's just so much more fun. Like, I think the Arcus Inteleon build maybe is better, but I think that was one of my top picks going into UIC was Arceus B-Barrel, because I just enjoyed the deck a lot. It was just fun to play B-Barrel. It was fun to not play an Inteleon deck as well. Like, sure, you get all your cards and all your combos, but, like, it's just been that for so long. I just really enjoy the flow of Arceus B-Barrel and having so much room to kind of do what you want with the deck, right? You have so much more space to kind of do whatever you want, which is just really, really freeing as far as, like, deck building goes, which is one thing I like about the Urshifu deck, I guess, as well, is because you play such thin lines of stuff, you also get to play so much stuff as well. But yeah, I think Arceus deck's got to, like, shake it up a little bit and try out some different stuff. And I think getting away from the Inteleon engine would definitely be a good initial step to start trying new stuff out. Because also, then when you bench your Manaphy, when Avery happens, you're not getting as punished, right? You can discard, oh, you want to discard my Crobat and my other Arceus? Sure, go ahead. I'm going to keep my Manaphy, my B-Barrel, and my second attacker, and then we're chilling, right? So,
Well, I'm going to be interested to see this next week how the online meta develops, because that's kind of like a good early look at, you know, where things are kind of headed, because, you know, there's a lot of online events still running and people will obviously take their Frankfurt results into consideration when building their decks. So next week we'll definitely break down much more before Indianapolis regionals and also before the Latin American regionals this next weekend after this weekend. So be sure to stay tuned for next week's episode. That's just a little early preview of Indy, which is going to be an exciting tournament. I think the meta is in a really good spot right now, and I think Pokemon's really fun to play right now as well, which is pretty nice to say.
Yeah, no, it feels good. It feels good. It definitely feels, and I was one of the people initially where I was like, Mew just feels too good. This is like not as enjoyable. It's not as fun. Like, you always have to worry about Mew, but we're almost getting to a point in the meta where you can almost take a loss to Mew. We're not there yet, I don't think. We definitely could maybe get to that point, to the point where you could take an unfavorable matchup or kind of just like a hard loss to Mew, which is like, I feel like what you want. You want the meta to be able to shift around, right? You want the top deck to be, be a top deck, but it's like, okay, if someone just comes through and counters it, then it should fall off, right? If the next deck just counters that and you move on and you rotate around, and or there's enough decks in the format where you don't have to worry about every single top deck, right? You know, if there's 5-6 tier one decks, definitely don't have to beat all of them, you know, just the ones you think are going to be most popular on the day, or the most successful into, you know, day two of a tournament. But definitely like where it's at overall. I think there's a lot of cool stuff going on, unless Urshifu is that next unbeatable tier one BDIF deck. But I don't think it's, I think there's a lot you can do up against Urshifu for sure, and it's not quite there. I think it's definitely abusing a lot of the way that decks are built right now, namely, you know, lack of Marnie, and then only kind of two top decks to compete against it, which were Arceus and Mew. It makes it easier for the deck to be kind of built and deal with those decks for sure.
Well, thanks so much to everyone for listening to this week's episode. I know it's a little different than normal, probably a little worse audio quality than you're used to. I'm in a hotel room, like we said at the beginning, so everything will be back to normal for next week. And shout outs to Azul for recording the podcast this week. I normally kind of handle all the the back end recording and like uploading of stuff. Yeah, the technical stuff. So shout outs to Azul for being flexible doing it so I can enjoy my vacation.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, thanks for listening, everyone. Happy to help out on that end. Chip, as always, guys, if you're watching on the YouTube, be sure to like, subscribe, comment, follow us on Twitter as well. We're on all of the audio platforms if you want to check us out over there and listen to us over there instead. Appreciate everything. All the support has been crazy, and we're both really enjoying doing the podcast, so we're going to keep coming at you with it every single week and try and be as consistent as possible. So we'll see you next Tuesday at 7 a.m. Eastern. Peace.
Peace.